For several days after giving her the little bunch of silk flowers, he brought her no presents, and he thought he was beginning to detect hints of disappointment when he appeared empty-handed. Then, 4 days out of Jurador, just as the sun was peeking over the horizon into a nearly cloudless sky, he got her and Seleucia out of the purple wagon. Well, he just wanted Tuon, but Seleucia might as well have been her shadow when it came to trying to separate them. He had commented on that once, making a joke, and both women went on talking as if he had not spoken. It was a good thing he knew Tuon could laugh at a joke, because sometimes she seemed to have no sense of humor at all. Seleucia, wrapped in a green wool cloak, with the cowl all but hiding her red headscarf, eyed him suspiciously, but then she nearly always did. Tuon never bothered with a scarf, yet the shortness of her black hair was not so apparent with the hood of her blue cloak up. "Cover your eyes, precious," he said. "I have a surprise for you."
"I like surprises," she replied, placing her hands over her big eyes. For an instant she smiled in anticipation, but only for an instant. "Some surprises, Toy." That had the sound of a warning.
Seleucia stood hard by her shoulder, and though the bosomy woman appeared completely at her ease, something told him she was as tense as a cat ready to leap. He suspected she did not like surprises. "Wait right there," he said, and ducked around the side of the purple wagon. When he returned, he was leading Pips and the Razor, both saddled and bridled. The mare stepped lively, frisking at the prospect of an outing. "You can look now. I thought you might like a ride."
They had hours. The show might as well have been deserted for all the evidence of life among the wagons. Only a handful had smoke rising from their metal chimneys.
"She's yours," he added, and stiffened as the words nearly froze in his throat. There was no doubt this time. He had said the horse was hers, and suddenly the dice were not beating so loudly in his head. It was not that they had slowed, he was sure of that. There had been more than one set rattling away. One had stopped when he made his agreement with Aludra, and another when he told Tuon the horse was hers. That was odd in itself. How could giving her a horse be fateful for him? But light it had been bad enough when he had to worry about one set of dice giving warning at a time. How many sets were still bouncing off the inside of his skull? How many more fateful moments were waiting to crash down on him? Tuon went immediately to the Razor, all smiles as she examined the animal as thoroughly as he had himself. She did train horses for fun, after all. Horses and Damani, the light help him. Seleucia was studying him, he realized, her expression an expressionless mask. Because of the horse or because he had gone stiff as a post?
"She's a Razor," he said, patting Pips's blunt nose. The gelding had been getting plenty of exercise, but the Razor's eagerness seemed to have infected him. "Damani Bloodborne favor Razors, and it's not likely you'll ever see one outside of Ered Daman. What will you name her?"
"It is bad luck to name a horse before riding it," Tuon replied, taking the reins. She was still beaming. Her big eyes shone. "She's a very fine animal, Toy. A wonderful gift. Either you have a good eye, or you were very lucky."
"I have a good eye, precious," he said warily. She seemed more delighted than even the Razor called for.
"If you say so. Where is Seleucia's mount?"
Oh, well, it had been worth a try. A smart man hedged his bets, though, so a sharp whistle brought Metwin at a trot leading a saddled Dapple. Matt ignored the wide grin that split the man's pale face. The Kyrian and Redarm had been sure he would not get away with leaving Seleucia behind, but there was no need to smirk over it. Matt judged the Dapple gelding, 10 years old, to be gentle enough for Seleucia. In his memory, ladies' maids seldom were more than tolerable riders, but the woman gave the animal a going-over as complete as Tuon's. And when she was done, she directed a look at Matt that said she would ride the horse so as not to make a bother, but she found it decidedly lacking. Women could compress a great deal into one look. Once clear of the field where the show was camped, Tuon walked the Razor along the road for a time, then took her to a trot, and then a canter. The surface was hard-packed yellow clay here, studded with edges of old paving stones. No trouble for a well-shod horse, though, and he had made sure of the Razor's shoes. Matt kept Pips even with Tuon, as much for the pleasure of watching her smile as anything else. When Tuon was enjoying herself,
The stern judge was forgotten, and pure delight shone on her face. Not that watching her was easy, since Seleucia had the dapple between them. The yellow-haired woman was a formidable chaperone, and by the sidelong glances she gave him, her small smiles, she very much enjoyed the job of frustrating him. At the start, they had the road to themselves, except for a few farm carts, but after a while a tinker caravan appeared ahead of them, a line of garishly painted and lacquered wagons rolling slowly southward down the other side of the road with massive dogs trotting alongside. Those dogs were the only real protection tinkers had. The driver of the lead wagon, a thing as red as Luca's coats, trimmed in yellow and with violent green and yellow wheels to boot, half stood to peer toward Matt, then sat back down and said something to the woman beside him, doubtless reassured by the presence of the two women with Matt. Tinkers were a cautious lot, of necessity. That whole caravan would whip up their horses and flee a single man they thought meant harm. Matt nodded to the fellow as the wagons began to pass. The lean gray-haired man's high-collared coat was as green as his wagon's wheels, and his wife's dress was striped in shades of blue, most bright enough to suit any of the show's performers. The gray-haired man raised his hand in a wave. And Tuon suddenly turned the razor and galloped into the trees, cloak streaming out behind her. In a flash, Seleucia had the dapple darting after her. Snatching his hat off so as not to lose it, Matt wheeled Pips and followed. Shouts rose from the wagons, but he paid them no mind. His attention was all on Tuon. He wished he knew what she was up to. Not escape, he was sure. Likely she was just trying to make him tear out his hair. If so, she was in a fair way for succeeding. Pips quickly reeled in the dapple and left a scowling Seleucia behind, flailing her mount with the reins, but Tuon and the razor kept their lead as the rolling land climbed toward hills. Startled flights of birds sprang up from beneath both animals' hooves, coveys of gray dove and of brown-speckled quail, sometimes ruffed brown grouse. All disaster needed was for the mare to be frightened by one of those. The best-trained mount could rear and fall when a bird burst up under hoof. Worse, Tuon rode like a madwoman, never slowing, only swerving from her line, where the underbrush lay dense, leaping trees toppled by old storms as if she had a clue what lay on the other side. Well, he had to ride like a madman himself to keep up, though he winced every time he set Pips to jump a tree trunk. Some were near as thick as he was tall. He dug his boot heels into the gelding's flanks, urging more speed, though he knew Pips was running as hard as he ever had. He had chosen too well in that bloody razor. Up and up they raced through the forest. As abruptly as she had begun her mad dash, Tuon reined in, well over a mile from the road. The trees were old here and widely spaced, black pines 40 paces tall and wide-spreading oaks with branches that arched down to touch the ground before rising again, and could have been sliced crosswise into tables to seat a dozen in comfort. Thick creepers shrouded half-buried boulders and stone outcrops, but aside from that, only a few weeds pushed through the mulch. Oaks that size killed off any lesser undergrowth beneath them. "Your animal is better than he looks," the fool woman said, patting her mount's neck when he reached her. Oh, she was all innocence, just out for a pleasant ride. "Maybe you do have a good eye." With the cowl of her cloak fallen down her back, her cap of short hair was visible, glistening like black silk. He suppressed a desire to stroke it. "Burn how good my eye is," he growled, clapping his hat on. He knew he should speak smoothly, but he could not have taken the roughness from his voice with a file. "Do you always ride like a moon-blinded idiot? You could have broken that mare's neck before she even got a name. Worse, you could have broken your own. I promised to get you home safely, and I mean to do just that. If you're going to risk killing yourself every time you go riding, then I won't let you ride." He wished he had those last words back as soon as they left his tongue. A man might laugh off a threat like that as a joke, maybe, if he were lucky. But a woman? Now all he could do was wait for the explosion. He expected Aludra's night flowers to pale by comparison. She raised the hood of her cloak, settling it just so. She studied him, tilting her head first one way, then the other. Finally, she nodded to herself.
"I name her Achaean. That means swallow."
Matt blinked. That was it? No eruption? "I know. A good name. It suits her." What was she about now? The woman almost never did or said what he expected.
"What is this place, Toy?" she said, frowning at the trees. "Or should I say, what was it? Do you know?"
What did she mean? What was this place? It was a bloody forest, was what it was. But suddenly, what had seemed a large boulder right in front of him, nearly obscured by thick vines, resolved into a huge stone head, slightly tilted to one side. A woman's head, he thought. Those smooth rondelles were probably meant for jewels in her hair. The statue it sat on must have been immense. A full span of the thing showed, yet only her eyes and the top of her head were out of the ground. And that long white stone outcrop with an oak tree's roots growing over it was a piece of a spiral column. All around them now he could make out bits of columns and large worked stones that plainly had been part of some grand structure and what had to be a stone sword 2 spans long, all half buried. Still, ruins of cities and monuments could be found in many places, and few even among Aes Sedai had any idea what they had been. Opening his mouth to say that he did not know, he caught sight through the trees of 3 tall hills in a row, perhaps another mile on. The middle hill had a cleft top, like a wedge cut cleanly out, while the hill on the left had 2. And he knew. There could hardly be 3 hills exactly like that anywhere else. Those hills had been called the Dancers when this place had been Londaran Kor, the capital city of Aharon. The road behind them had been paved then and ran through the heart of the city, which had sprawled for miles. People had said that the artistry in stone that the Ogier had practiced in Tarvalen they had perfected in Londaran Kor. Of course, the people of every Ogier-built city had claimed their own outdid Tarvalen, confirming Tarvalen as the touchstone. He had a number of memories of the city, dancing at a ball in the Palace of the Moon, carousing in soldiers' taverns where veiled dancers writhed, watching the procession of flutes during the blessing of the swords. But oddly, he had another memory of those hills, from near enough 500 years after the Trollocs left no stone standing in Londaran Kor, and Aharon died in blood and fire. Why it had been necessary for Nerevan and Isandara to invade Sciota, as the land was then, he did not know. Those old memories were fragments however long a time anyone covered, and full of gaps. He had no idea why those hills had been called the Dancers, either, or what the Blessing of the Swords was. But he remembered being an Essendarin lord in a battle fought among these ruins, and he remembered having those hills in view when he took an arrow through his throat. He must have fallen no more than 0.5 mile from the very spot where he sat Pips, drowning in his own blood. "Light, I hate to remember dying," he thought, and the thought turned to a coal burning in his brain, a coal that burned hotter and hotter. He remembered those men's deaths, not just one, but dozens of them. He remembered dying.
"Toy, are you ill?"
Tuan brought the mare close and peered up into his face. Concern filled her big eyes.
"You've gone pale as the moon."
"I'm right as spring water," he muttered. She was close enough for him to kiss if he bent his head, but he did not move. He could not. He was thinking so furiously he had nothing left for motion. Somehow, only the light knew, the eel fin had gathered the memories they had planted in his head. How could they harvest memory from a corpse? A corpse in the world of men, at that. He was certain they never came to this side of that twisted door-framed Tirangreal for longer than minutes at a time. A way occurred to him, one he did not like, not a scrap. Maybe they created some sort of link to any human who visited them, a link that allowed them to copy all of a man's memories after that, right up to the moment he died. In some of those memories from other men, he was white-haired. In some, only a few years older than he really was. And everything in between. But there were none of childhood or growing up. What were the odds of that, if they had just stuffed him with random bits and pieces, likely things they considered rubbish or had done with? What did they do with memories, anyway? They had to have some reason for gathering them beyond giving them away again. No, he was just trying to avoid where this led. Burn him. The bloody foxes were inside his head right then. They had to be. It was the only explanation that made sense.
Well, you look as if you're about to vomit, Tuan said, backing the razor away with a grimace. Who in the show would have herbs? I have some knowledge there.
I'm all right, I tell you.
In truth, he did want a sick up. Having those foxes in his head was 1,000 times worse than the dice, however hard the dice rattled. Could the eel fin see through his eyes? Light, what was he going to do? He doubted any Aes Sedai could heal him of this, not that he would trust them to, not when it meant leaving off the fox head. There was nothing to be done. He would just have to live with it. He groaned at the thought.
Cantering up to them, Seleucia gave him and Tuan each a quick look as if considering what they might have been up to in their time alone. But then she had taken her time in catching up, giving them that time. That was hopeful.
Next time you can ride this gentle creature and I will ride your gelding, she told Matt. High lady, people from those wagons are following us with dogs. They're afoot, but they will be here soon. The dogs don't bark. Trained guard dogs, then, Tuan said, gathering her reins. Mounted, we can avoid them easily enough.
No need to try and no use, Matt told her. He should have expected this. Those people are tinkers, Tuatha'an, and they're no danger to anybody. They couldn't be violent if their lives depended on it. That's no exaggeration, just simple truth. But they saw you two go herring off trying to get away from me, as it must have seemed, and me chasing after. Now that those dogs have a scent trail, the tinkers will follow us all the way back to the show if need be to make sure you two haven't been kidnapped or harmed. We'll go meet them to save the time and trouble.
It was not the tinkers' time he cared about.
Luca probably would not care one way or the other if a bunch of tinkers getting in the way delayed the show setting out, but Matt certainly would.
Seleucia scowled at him indignantly, and her fingers flew, but Tuan laughed.
Toy wishes to be commanding today, Seleucia. I will let him command and see how he does.
Bloody kind of her. They trotted back the way they had come, riding around the fallen trees this time, though now and then Tuan would gather her reins as if she meant to jump one, then give Matt a mischievous grin. And it was not long before the tinkers came into sight, running through the trees behind their huge mastiffs, like a flight of butterflies. 50 or so men and women in bright colors, often in jarring combinations. A man might be wearing a red and blue striped coat and baggy yellow trousers tucked into knee boots, or a violet-colored coat above red trousers, or worse. Some women wore dresses striped in as many colors as there were colors, and even colors Matt had no name for, while others wore skirts and blouses as varied in hue and as clashing as the men's coats and trousers. A fair number had shawls as well, to add more colors to the eye-scrambling blend. Except for the gray-haired man who had been driving the lead wagon, they all appeared to be short of their middle years. He must be the seeker, the leader of the caravan. Matt dismounted, and after a moment, Tuan and Seleucia did too. The tinkers stopped at that, calling their dogs to heel. The big animals slumped to the ground, tongues lolling out, and the people came on more slowly. None carried so much as a stick, and though Matt wore no weapons that showed, they eyed him warily. The men clustered in front of him while the women gathered around Tuan and Seleucia. There was no threat in it, but as easily as that, Tuan and Seleucia were separated from him, off where the tinker women could make inquiries. Suddenly it occurred to him that Tuan might think it a fine game to claim he was trying to bother her. She and Seleucia could ride off while he was trying to contend with tinkers crowding around him and Pips, so he could not climb into the saddle. That was all they would do, but unless he was willing to fight his way clear, they might keep him here for hours, maybe, to give that pair time to escape.
The gray-haired man bowed with his hands pressed to his chest. Peace be on you and yours, my lord. Forgiveness if we intrude, but we feared our dogs had frightened the lady's horses.
Matt responded with a bow in the same fashion.
Peace be on you always, seeker, and on all the people. The lady's horses weren't frightened. The ladies are impetuous at times.
What were the women saying? He tried to eavesdrop, but their voices were low murmurs.
You know something of the people, my lord?
The seeker sounded surprised and had a right to.
The Tuathuan kept away from anywhere larger than a moderate-sized village. They would seldom encounter anyone in a silk coat.
"Only a little," Matt replied.
"A very little." He had memories of meeting tinkers, but he himself had never spoken to one before. What were those bloody women saying?
"Will you answer me a question? I've seen a number of your caravans the past few days, more than I'd have expected to, and all heading toward Abu Dhar. Is there a reason?"
The man hesitated, darting a glance toward the women. They were still murmuring away, and he had to be wondering why their conversation was lasting so long. After all, it only needed a moment to say, "Yes, I need help," or the opposite.
"It is the people called Shon Chan, my lord," he said finally. "Word is spreading among the people that there is safety where the Shon Chan rule, and equal justice for all. Elsewhere, you understand, my lord."
Matt did. Like the show folk, tinkers were strangers wherever they went, and worse, strangers with an undeserved reputation for thievery. Well, they stole no more often than anyone else, and a deserved one for trying to entice young people into joining them. And on top of it, for tinkers, there was no question of fighting back if anybody tried to rob them or chase them away.
"Take care, Seeker. Their safety comes at a price, and some of their laws are harsh. You know what they do with women who can channel?"
"Thank you for your concern, my lord," the man said calmly. "But few of our women ever begin channeling, and if one does, we will do as we always do, and take her to Tarvalen."
Abruptly, the women began laughing. Great gales and peals. The Seeker relaxed visibly. If the women were laughing, Matt was not the kind of man who would strike them down or kill them for getting in his way. For Matt's part, he scowled. There was nothing in that laughter that he liked. The tinkers made their departure with more apologies from the Seeker for having bothered them, but the women kept looking back and laughing behind cupped hands. Some of the men leaned close as they walked, plainly asking questions, but the women just shook their heads and looked back again, laughing.
"What did you tell them?" Matt asked sourly.
"Oh, that's none of your business now, is it, Toy?" Tuan replied, and Seleucia laughed. Oh, she bloody cackled, she did. He decided he was better off not knowing. Women just purely enjoyed planting needles in a man.
Chapter 9. A Short Path. Tuan and Seleucia were not the only women who caused Matt trouble, of course. Sometimes it seemed that most of the trouble in his life came from women, which he could not understand at all, since he always tried to treat them well. Even Aginin gave her share of grief, though it was the smallest share.
"I was right. You do think you can marry her," she drawled when he asked her for help with Tuan.
She and Doman were seated on the steps of their wagon with their arms around each other. A trickle of smoke rose from Doman's pipe. It was mid-morning on a fine day, though gathering clouds threatened rain for later, and the performers were putting on their acts for the inhabitants of four small villages that combined perhaps equaled Runyon Crossing in size. Matt had no desire to go watch. Oh, he still enjoyed watching the contortionists, and better still the female acrobats and tumblers, but when you saw jugglers and fire-eaters and the like every day just about, even Majora and her leopards became, well, less interesting, if not exactly ordinary.
"Never you mind what I think, Aginin. Will you tell me what you know of her? Trying to find out from her is like fishing blindfolded and barehanded in a briar patch trying to catch a rabbit."
"My name is Lyowin Cotton. Don't forget it again," she said in tones suitable for giving orders on a ship's deck.
Her eyes tried to drive the command home like blue hammers.
"Why should I help you? You aim too high above yourself, a mole yearning for the sun. You could face execution for simply saying you want to marry her. It's disgusting. Besides, I've left all that behind me. Or it's left me," she added bitterly.
Doman gave her a one-armed hug.
"If you've left all that behind you, what do you care how disgusting my wanting to marry her is?"
There, it was out in the open. Partly, at least.
Doman removed the pipe from his mouth long enough to blow a smoke ring aimed at Matt's face.
If she does not want to help you, then give over.
He gave it that same ship's deck voice of command. Aginin muttered under her breath. She appeared to be arguing with herself. Finally, she shook her head.
No, Bale, he's right. If I'm cast adrift, then I have to find a new ship and a new course. I can never return to Shonchan, so I might as well cut the cable and be done with it.
What she knew of Tuan was mainly rumor. It seemed the Imperial family lived their lives behind walls even when in plain sight, and only whispers of what went on behind those walls escaped. Yet those were sufficient to make the hair on the back of Matt's neck stand up. His wife-to-be had had a brother and a sister assassinated? After they tried to have her killed, true, but still. What kind of family went around killing one another? The Shonchan blood and the Imperial family, for starters. Half of her siblings were dead, assassinated, most of them, and maybe the others, too. Some of what Aginin, Lyle Wynn, had to tell was generally known among Shonchan, and hardly more comforting. Tuan would have been schooled in intrigue from infancy, schooled in weapons and fighting with her bare hands, heavily guarded yet expected to be her own last line of defense. All of those born to the blood were taught to dissemble, to disguise their intentions and ambitions. Power shifted constantly among the blood, some climbing higher, others slipping down, and the dance was only faster and more dangerous in the Imperial family. The Empress, she started to add, may she live forever, and half choked in swallowing the words, then closed her eyes for a long moment before continuing. The Empress had borne many children, as every Empress did, so that among those who survived there would be one fit to rule after her. It would not do to have someone who was stupid or a fool ascend the crystal throne. Tuan was accounted very far from either. Light. The woman he was to marry was as bad as Warder and Aes Sedai wrapped into one, and maybe as dangerous. He had several conversations with Aginin. He was careful to name her Lyawin to her face, lest she go for him with her dagger. Yet he thought of her as Aginin, trying to learn more, but her knowledge of the blood was largely from the outside looking in, and her knowledge of the Imperial Court, by her own admission, little better than that of a street urchin in Shandar. The day he gave Tuan the mare, he had ridden alongside Aginin's wagon having one of those fruitless conversations. He had accompanied Tuan and Seleucia for a time, but they kept looking at him sideways, then exchanging glances and giggling. Over what they had told the Tinker women, without a sliver of doubt. A man could only take so much of that sort of thing.
A clever gift, that mare, Aginin said, leaning out from the driver's seat to look up the line of wagons.
Doman was handling the reins. She took her turn sometimes, but handling a team was not among the skills she had learned on ships.
How did you know?
Know what? He asked. She straightened and adjusted her wig. He did not know why she continued to wear the thing. Her own black hair was short, but no shorter than Seleucia's.
About courting gifts. Among the blood, when you are courting someone higher than you, a traditional gift is something exotic or rare. Best of all is if you can connect the gift somehow to one of the recipient's pleasures, and it's well known the High Lady loves horses. It's good you've acknowledged that you don't expect to be her equal, too. Not that this is going to work, you understand. I don't have a clue why she's still here. Now you've stopped guarding her, but you can't believe she'll actually say the words. When she marries, it will be for the good of the Empire, not because some layabout like you gave her a horse or made her smile.
Matt ground his teeth to keep from shouting a curse. He had acknowledged what? No wonder a set of bloody dice had stopped. Tuan would let him forget this when it snowed on Sunday. He was certain sure of that. If Lylwyn bloody shipless gave him small griefs, the Aes Sedai managed larger. Aes Sedai liked nothing better. He was resigned to them traipsing about every village and town they stopped at, asking questions and doing the light knew what else. He had no choice but resignation, with no way to stop them. They claimed to be taking care, at least Teslin and Edesina did.
Jolene snapped that he was a fool for worrying, yet an Aes Sedai taking care was still clearly a woman of consequence whether or not anybody recognized what she was. Lacking the coin for silks, they had purchased bolts of fine wool in Jurador, and the seamstresses worked as hard for Aes Sedai as they did for Matt's gold, so they strolled about dressed like wealthy merchants and as sure of themselves as any noble ever born. Nobody saw one of them walk five strides without knowing that she expected the world to conform itself to her. Three women like that, with a traveling show at that, were sure to cause talk. At least Jolene left her great serpent ring in her belt pouch. The other two had lost theirs to the Seanchan. If Matt had seen Jolene with the thing actually on her finger, he thought he would have wept. He got no more reports on their activities from the former Suldam. Jolene had Bethamon firmly in hand. The tall, dark woman ran when Jolene said run and jumped when she said toad. Edesina was giving her lessons too, but Jolene considered Bethamon a personal project for some reason. She was never harsh, that Matt saw, not after the face-slapping, but you might have thought she was getting Bethamon ready to go to the tower, and Bethamon returned a sort of gratitude that made it clear her loyalties had shifted. As for Sita, the yellow-haired woman was so frightened of the sisters that she did not dare follow them any longer. She actually shivered when he suggested it. Strange as it seemed, Sita and Bethamon had been so accustomed to how Seanchan women who could channel saw themselves that they had really believed Aes Sedai could not be much different. They were dangerous when off the leash, yet dangerous dogs could be handled by someone who knew how, and they were experts with that particular sort of dangerous dog. Now they knew that Aes Sedai were not dogs of any kind. They were wolves. Sita would have found another place to sleep had that been possible, and he learned from Mistress Annan that the Seanchan woman put her hands over her eyes whenever Jolene or Edesina was teaching Bethamon in the wagon.
"I'm certain she can see the weaves," Satala said.
He would have said she sounded envious, except that he doubted she envied anyone.
"She's halfway to admitting it, or she wouldn't hide her eyes. Soon or late she'll come around and want to learn, too."
Maybe she did sound envious at that. He could have wished for Sita to come around soon rather than late. Another student would have left the Aes Sedai less time to trouble him. If the show was halted, he could hardly turn around without seeing Jolene or Edesina peering around the corner of a tent or wagon at him. Usually the fox head cooled on his chest. He could not prove they were actually channeling at him, yet he was certain of it. He was unsure which of them found the loophole in his protection that Adelius and Van Deen had, that something thrown with the power would hit him, but after that he could barely leave his tent without getting hit by a rock and later by other things, burning sparks like a shower from a forge fire, stinging sparks that made him leap and his hair try to stand on end. He was positive that Jolene was behind it. If for no other reason, he never saw her without Blerick and Fenn, or both, nearby for protection. And she smiled at him like a cat smiling at a mouse. He was planning how to get her alone, it was that or spend his time hiding from her, when she and Teslin got into a shouting match that cleared Edesina out of the whitewashed wagon almost as quickly as Bethamon and Sita. And those two ran out and stood gaping at the wagon. The yellow sister calmly went back to brushing her long black hair, lifting it up with one hand and sweeping the wooden hairbrush down it with the other. Seeing Matt, she smiled at him without ceasing the motions of her brush. The medallion went cold, and the shouting vanished as though cut off by a knife. He never learned what was behind that power-woven shield. Teslin favored him somewhat, yet when he asked her, she gave him one of those looks and silence. It was Aes Sedai business and none of his. Whatever had gone on in there, though, the rocks stopped and the sparks. He tried thanking Teslin, but she was having none of it.
"When something be no to be spoken of, it be no to be spoken of," she told him firmly. "It would be well for you to learn that lesson if you are to be around sisters. And I think your life be tied to Aes Sedai now if it was no before."
Bloody thing for her to say. She never cracked her teeth about his Tirangriol, but the same could not be said of Jolene and Edesina, even after the argument. They tried to bully him into handing it over every single day, Edesina cornering him by herself, Jolene with her warders glowering over her shoulders at him. Tirangriol were rightfully the property of the White Tower, Tirangriel needed proper study, particularly one with the odd properties this one possessed. Tirangriel were potentially dangerous, too much so to be left in the hands of the uninitiated. Neither said especially a man's hands, but Jolene came close. He began to worry that the Green would have Bleric and Fenn simply take it from him. That pair still suspected he had been involved in what had happened to her, and the dark looks they gave him said they wanted any excuse to beat him like a drum.
"That would be stealing," Mistress Annan told him in a lecturing tone, gathering her cloak around her.
The sunlight was beginning to fade, and coolness already setting in. They were standing outside Tuon's wagon, and he was hoping to get inside in time to be fed. Noel and Olver were already inside. Setala was apparently off to visit the Aes Sedai, something she did frequently.
"Tower law is quite clear on that. There might be considerable discussion over whether it had to be given back to you. I rather think it would not be, in the end. But Jolene would face a fairly harsh penance for theft all the same."
"Maybe she'd think it worth a penance," he muttered. His stomach rumbled. The potted finches and creamed onions that Lopin had presented proudly for his midday meal had both turned out to be spoiling, to the tyrant's extreme mortification, which meant Matt had had a heel of bread since breakfast and no more. "You know an awful lot about the White Tower."
"What I know, Lord Matt, is that you've made just about every misstep a man can make with Aes Sedai, short of trying to kill one. The reason I came with you in the first place instead of going with my husband, half the reason I'm still here, is to try to keep you from making too many missteps. Truth to tell, I don't know why I should care, but I do, and that's that. If you had let yourself be guided by me, you'd not be in trouble with them now. I can't say how much I can recover for you, not now, but I am still willing to try."
Matt shook his head. There were only two ways to deal with Aes Sedai without getting burned: let them walk all over you or stay away from them. He would not do the first, and could not do the second. So he had to find a third way, and he doubted it could come from following Setala's advice. Women's advice about Aes Sedai generally was to follow the first path, though they never worded it that way. They talked of accommodation. But it was never the Aes Sedai who was expected to do any accommodating.
"Half the reason. What's the other?"
He grunted as though he had been punched in the stomach.
"Tuon? You think I can't be trusted with Tuon?"
Mistress Annan laughed at him, a fine, rich laugh.
"You are a rogue, my lord. Now, some rogues make fine husbands once they've been tamed a little around the edges. My Jasper was a rogue when I met him. But you still think you can nibble a pastry here, nibble a pastry there, then dance off to the next."
"There's no dancing away from this one," Matt said, frowning up at the wagon door. The dice clicked away in his head. "Not for me." He was not sure he really wanted to dance away anymore, but want and wish as he might, he was well and truly caught.
"Like that, is it?" she murmured. "Oh, you've chosen a fine one to break your heart."
"That's as may be, Mistress Annan, but I have my reasons. I'd better get inside before they eat everything." He turned toward the steps at the back of the wagon, and she laid a hand on his arm.
"Could I see it? Just to see?"
There was no doubt what she meant. He hesitated, then fished in the neck of his shirt for the leather cord that held the medallion. He could not have said why. He had refused Jolene and Edesina even a glimpse. It was a fine piece of work, a silver fox head nearly as big as his palm. Only one eye showed, and enough daylight remained to see, if you looked close, that the pupil was half-shaded to form the ancient symbol of Aes Sedai. Her hand trembled slightly as she traced a finger around that eye. She had said she only wanted to see it, but he allowed the touching. She breathed out a long sigh. "You were Aes Sedai once," he said quietly, and her hand froze. She recovered herself so quickly that he might have imagined it. She was stately Setala Annan, the innkeeper from Ebu Dar, with the big golden hoops in her ears and the marriage knife dangling hilt down into her round cleavage, about as far from an Aes Sedai as could be.
"The sisters
think I'm lying about never having been to the tower. They think I was a servant there as a young woman, and listened where I shouldn't have.
They haven't seen you looking at this. He bounced the fox head once on his hand before tucking it safely back under his shirt. She pretended not to care, and he pretended not to know she was pretending. Her lips twitched into a brief, rueful smile, as if she knew what he was thinking.
The sisters would see it if they could let themselves, she said, as simply as if she were discussing the chances of rain. But I said I expect that when certain things happen, the woman will go away decently and die soon after. I went away, but Jasper found me half-starved and sick on the streets of Abu Dhar, and took me to his mother.
She chuckled, just a woman telling how she met her husband.
He used to take in stray kittens, too. Now you know some of my secrets, and I know some of yours. Shall we keep them to ourselves?
What secrets of mine do you know? He demanded, instantly wary. Some of his secrets were dangerous to have known, and if too many knew of them, they were not really secrets anymore. Mistress Annan glanced at the wagon, frowning.
That girl is playing a game with you as surely as you are playing one with her. Not the same game that you are. She's more like a general plotting a battle than a woman being courted. If she learns you're moonstruck with her, though, she'll still gain the advantage. I'm willing to let you have an even chance, or as near to one as any man has with a woman of any brains. Do we have an agreement?
We do, he replied fervently. That we do.
He would not have been surprised if the dice stopped then, but they went on bouncing. Had the sisters' fixation on his medallion been the only problem they gave him, had they contented themselves with creating rumors everywhere the show stopped, he could have said those days were no more than tolerably bad for traveling with Aes Sedai. Unfortunately, by the time the show departed Jurador, they had learned who Tuan was. Not that she was the daughter of the Nine Moons, but that she was a Shan Chan High Lady, someone of rank and influence.
"Do you take me for a fool?"
Luca protested when Matt accused him of telling them. He squared up beside his wagon, fists on his hips, a tall man full of indignation and ready to fight over it by his glare.
"That's a secret I want buried deep until she says I can use that warrant of protection. That won't be much use if she revokes it because I told something she wants hidden."
But his voice was a shade too earnest, and his eyes shifted a hair from meeting Matt's directly. The truth of it was, Luca liked to boast nearly as much as he liked gold. He must have thought it was safe, to tell the sisters, and only realized the snarl he had created after the words were out of his mouth. A snarl it was, as tangled as a pit full of snakes. The High Lady Tuan, readily at hand, presented an opportunity no Aes Sedai could have resisted. Teslin was every bit as bad as Jolene and Edesina. The three of them visited Tuan in her wagon daily, and descended on her when she went out for a walk. They talked of truces and treaties and negotiations, tried to learn what connection she had to the leaders of the invasion, attempted to convince her to help arrange talks to end the fighting. They even offered to help her leave the show and return home. Unfortunately for them, Tuan did not see three Aes Sedai, representatives of the White Tower, perhaps the greatest power on Earth, not even after the seamstresses began delivering their riding dresses and they could change out of the ragbag leavings Matt had been able to find for them. She saw two escaped Damani and a Marath Damani, and she had no use for either until they were decently collared. Her phrase, that. When they came to her wagon, she latched the door, and if they managed to get inside before she could, she left. When they cornered her, or tried to, she walked around them the same as walking around a stump. They all but talked themselves hoarse, and she refused to listen. Any Aes Sedai could teach a stone patience if she had reason, yet they were unaccustomed to flat being ignored. Matt could see the frustration growing, the tight eyes and tighter mouths that took longer and longer to relax, the hands gripping skirts in fists to keep them from grabbing Tuan and shaking her. It all came to a head sooner than he expected, and not at all in the way he had imagined. The night after he gave Tuan the mare, he ate his supper with her and Solusha. and with Noel and Alvar, of course. That pair managed as much time with Tuon as he did. Lopin and Nerim, as formal as if they were in a palace instead of squeezed for room to move, served a typical early spring meal, stringy mutton with peas that had been dried and turnips that had sat too long in somebody's cellar. It was too early yet for anything to be near harvesting. Still, Lopin had made a pepper sauce for the mutton, Nerim had found pine nuts for the peas. There was plenty to go around, and nothing tasted off, so it was as fine a meal as could be managed. Alvar left once supper was done, having already had his games with Tuon, and Matt changed places with Seleucia to play stones. Noel remained, too, despite any number of telling looks, rambling on about the Seven Towers and dead Melkir, which apparently had overtopped anything in Kyrian and Sholar Bella, the City of 10,000 Bells in Arafel, and all manner of borderland wonders, strange spires made of crystal harder than steel, and a metal bowl 100 paces across set into a hillside and the like. Sometimes he interjected comments on Matt's play, that he was exposing himself on the left, that he was setting a fine trap on the right, and just when Tuon looked ready to fall into it. That sort of thing. Matt kept his mouth shut except for chatting with Tuon, though it took gritting his teeth more than once to accomplish. Tuon found Noel's natter entertaining. He was studying the board, wondering whether he might have a small chance of gaining a draw, when Jolene led Teslin and Edesina into the wagon like Haughty on a pedestal, smooth-faced Aes Sedai to their toenails. Jolene was wearing her great serpent ring. Squeezing by Seleucia, giving her very cold looks when she was slow to move aside, they arrayed themselves at the foot of the narrow table. Noel went very still, eyeing the sisters sideways, one hand beneath his coat, as if the fool thought his knives would do any good here. "There must be an end to this, High Lady," Jolene said, very pointedly ignoring Matt. She was telling, not pleading, announcing what would be because it had to be. "Your people have brought a war to these lands such as we have not seen since the War of the Hundred Years, perhaps not since the Trolloc Wars. Tarmon Gaiden is approaching, and this war must end before it comes, lest it bring disaster to the whole world. It threatens no less than that. So there will be an end to your petulance. You will carry our offer to whoever commands among you. There can be peace until you return to your own lands across the sea, or you can face the full might of the White Tower followed by every throne from the Borderlands to the Sea of Storms. The Ammerlin Seat has likely summoned them against you already. I have heard of vast Borderland armies already in the south, and other armies moving. Better to end this without more bloodshed, though. So avert your people's destruction and help bring this peace." Matt could not see Edesina's reaction, but Teslin simply blinked. For an Aes Sedai, that was as good as a gasp. Maybe this was not exactly what she had expected Jolene to say. For his part, he groaned under his breath. Jolene was no Grey, as deft as a skilled juggler in negotiations, that was for sure, but neither was he, and he still figured she had found a short path to putting Tuon's back up. But Tuon folded her hands in her lap beneath the table and sat very straight, looking right through the Aes Sedai. Her face was as stern as it had ever been for him. "Seleucia," she said quietly. Moving up behind Teslin, the yellow-haired woman bent long enough to take something from beneath the blanket Matt was sitting on. As she straightened, everything seemed to happen all at once. There was a click, and Teslin screamed, clapping her hands to her throat. The fox head turned to ice against Matt's chest, and Jolene's head whipped around with an incredulous stare for the red. Edesina turned and ran for the door, which swung half open, then slammed shut. Slammed against Blerick or Fenn by the sound of men falling down the wagon's steps. Edesina jerked to a halt and stood very stiffly, arms at her sides and divided skirts pressed against her legs by invisible cords. All that in moments, and Seleucia had not stayed still. She bent briefly to the bed Noel was sitting on, then snapped the silver collar of another Edam around Jolene's neck. Matt could see that was what Teslin was gripping with both hands. She was not trying to take it off, just holding on to it, but her knuckles were white. The red's narrow face was an image of despair, her eyes staring and haunted. Jolene had regained the utter calm of an Aes Sedai, but she did touch the segmented collar encircling her neck. "If you think you can—" she began, then cut off abruptly, her mouth going tight. An angry light shone in her eyes.
You see, the Adam can be used to punish, though that is seldom done. Tuan stood, and she had the bracelet of an Adam on each wrist, the gleaming leashes snaking away under the blankets on the beds. How in the light had she managed to get her hands on those?
No, Matt said. You promised not to harm my followers, Precious.
Maybe not the wisest thing to use that name now, but it was too late to call it back.
You've kept your promises so far. Don't go back on one now.
I promised not to cause dissension among your followers, Toy, she said snippily. And in any case, it is very clear that these three are not your followers.
The small sliding door used to talk to whoever was driving or pass out food slid open with a loud bang. She glanced over her shoulder, and it slid shut with a louder. A man cursed outside and began beating at the door.
The Adam can also be used to give pleasure as a great reward, Tuan told Jolene, ignoring the hammering fist behind her.
Jolene's lips parted, and her eyes grew very wide. She swayed, and the rope-suspended table swung as she caught herself with both hands to keep from falling. If she was impressed, though, she hit it well. She did smooth her dark gray skirts once, after she was upright again, but that might have meant nothing. Her face was all Aes Sedai composure. Adesina, looking over her shoulder, matched that calm gaze, although she now wore the third Adam around her neck. And come to it, her face was paler than usual. But Teslin had begun weeping silently, shoulders shaking, tears leaking down her cheeks. Noel was tensed, a man ready to do something stupid. Matt kicked him under the table, and, when the man glared at him, shook his head. Noel's scowl deepened, but he took his hand out of his coat and leaned back against the wall. Still glaring. Well, let him. Knives were no use here. But maybe words could be. Much better if this could be ended with words.
Listen, Matt said to Tuan. If you think, you'll see 100 reasons this won't work. Light you can learn to channel yourself. Doesn't knowing that change anything? You're not far different from them.
He might as well have turned to smoke and blown away for all the attention she paid.
Try to embrace Sidar, she drawled, stern eyes steady on Jolene. Her voice was quite mild in comparison to her gaze, yet plainly she expected obedience.
Obedience? She looked a bloody leopard staring at three tethered goats.
And strangely, more beautiful than ever.
A beautiful leopard who might rake him with her claws as soon as the goats. Well, he had faced a leopard a few times before this, and those were his own memories. There was an odd sort of exhilaration that came with confronting a leopard.
Go ahead, she went on. You know the shield is gone.
Jolene gave a small grunt of surprise, and Tuan nodded.
Good. You've obeyed for the first time, and learned that you cannot touch the power while you wear the Adam unless I wish it. But now I wish you to hold the power, and you do, though you didn't try to embrace it.
Jolene's eyes widened slightly, a small crack in her calm.
And now, Tuan went on, I wish you not to be holding the power, and it is gone from you. Your first lessons.
Jolene drew a deep breath. She was beginning to look, not afraid, but uneasy.
Blood and bloody ashes, woman, Matt growled. Do you think you can parade them around in those leashes without anyone noticing?
A heavy thump came from the door. A second produced the sound of cracking wood. Whoever was beating at the wooden window was still at it, too. Somehow that caused no sense of urgency. If the warders got in, what could they do?
I will house them in the wagon they are using and exercise them at night, she snapped irritably. I am nothing like these women, Toy. Nothing like them. Perhaps I could learn, but I choose not to, just as I choose not to steal or commit murder. That makes all the difference.
Recovering herself with visible effort, she sat down with her hands on the table, focused on the Aes Sedai once again.
I've had considerable success with one woman like you,
Edesina gasped, murmured a name too low to be caught.
"Yes," Tuan said. "You must have met my Mylan in the kennels or at exercise. I will train you all as well as she is. You have been cursed with a dark taint, but I will teach you to have pride in the service you give the Empire."
"I didn't bring these three out of Ebu Dar so you could take them back," Matt said firmly, sliding himself along the bed. The fox head grew colder still, and Tuan made a startled sound.
"How did you do that, Toy? The weave melted when it touched you."
"It's a gift, precious." As he stood up, Seleucia started toward him, crouching, her hands outstretched and pleading. Fear painted her face.
"You must not," she began.
"No," Tuan said sharply. Seleucia straightened and backed away, though she kept her eyes on him. Strangely, the fear vanished from her expression. He shook his head in wonder. He knew the bosomy woman obeyed Tuan instantly. She was Sojin, after all, as much owned as Tuan's horse, and she actually thought that right and good. But how obedient did you need to be to lose your fear at an order?
"They have annoyed me, Toy," Tuan said as he put his hands on Teslin's collar.
Still trembling, tears still streaming down her cheeks, the red looked as though she could not believe he would actually remove the thing.
"They annoy me, too."
Placing his fingers just so, he pressed, and the collar clicked open. Teslin seized his hands and began kissing them.
"Thank you,"
she wept over and over.
"Thank you, thank you."
Matt cleared his throat.
"You're welcome, but there's no need for...
Would you stop that?
Teslin!"
Reclaiming his hands took some effort.
"I want them to stop annoying me, Toy," Tuan said as he turned to Jolene.
From anyone else, that might have been petulant. The dark little woman made it a demand.
"I think they'll agree to that after this," he said dryly.
But Jolene was looking up at him with a stubborn set to her jaw.
"You will agree, won't you?"
The green said nothing.
"I do agree," Teslin said quickly. "We do all agree." "Yes, we all agree," Edesina added.
Jolene stared at him silently, stubbornly, and Matt sighed.
"I could let Precious keep you for a few days until you change your mind."
Jolene's collar clicked open in his hands.
"But I won't."
Still staring into his eyes, she touched her throat as though to confirm the collar was gone.
"Would you like to be one of my warders?" she asked, then laughed softly. "No need to look like that. Even if I would bond you against your will, I couldn't so long as you have that Tirangriol."
"I agree, Master Cawthon.
It may cost our best chance to stop the Seanchan, but I will no longer bother Precious."
Tuan hissed like a doused cat, and he sighed again.
"What you gained on the swings, you lost on the roundabouts."
He spent part of that night doing what he liked least in the world. Working. Digging a deep hole to bury the three Adam. He did the job himself because, surprisingly, Jolene wanted them. They were Tirangriol, after all, and the White Tower needed to study them. That might well have been so, but the Tower would just have to find their Adam elsewhere. He was fairly certain that none of the Red Arms would have handed them over if he'd told them to bury the things, yet he was taking no chances that they would reappear to cause more trouble. It started raining before the hole was knee-deep. A cold, driving rain, and by the time he was done, he was soaked to the skin and mud to his waist. A fine end to a fine night, with the dice bouncing around his skull. Chapter 10. A Village in Shiota. The following day brought a respite, or so it seemed. Tuan, in a blue silk riding dress and her wide, tooled leather belt, not only rode beside him as the show rolled slowly north, she waggled her fingers at Seleucia when the woman tried to put her dun between them. Seleucia had acquired her own mount somehow, a compact gelding that could not match Pip's or Achaean, but still surpassed the Dapple by a fair margin. The blue-eyed woman, with a green headscarf beneath her cowl today, fell in on Tuan's other side, and her face would have done an Aes Sedai proud when it came to giving nothing away. Matt could not help grinning.
Let her hide frustration for a change. Lacking horses, the real Aes Sedai were confined to their wagon. Metwin was too far away on the driver's seat of the purple wagon to overhear what he said to Tuon. Only a few thin clouds remained in the sky from the night's rain, and all seemed right in the world. Even the dice bouncing in his head could steal nothing from that. Well, there were bad moments, but only moments. Early on, a flight of ravens winged overhead, a dozen or more big black birds. They flew swiftly, never deviating from their line, but he eyed them anyway until they dwindled to specks and vanished. Nothing to spoil the day there, not for him at least, maybe for someone farther north.
"Did you see some omen in them, Toy?" Tuon asked.
She was as graceful in the saddle as she was in everything else she did. He could not recall seeing her be awkward about anything.
"Most omens I know concerning ravens specifically have to do with them perching on someone's rooftop or cawing at dawn or dusk."
"They can be spies for the Dark One," he told her. "Sometimes. Crows, too. And rats. But they didn't stop to look at us, so we don't need to worry." Running a green-gloved hand across the top of her head, she sighed.
"Toy, Toy," she murmured, resettling the cowl of her cloak. "How many children's tales do you believe? Do you believe that if you sleep on old Hobbs Hill under a full moon, the foxes will give you true answers to 3 questions, or that snakes steal people's skins and take the nourishment from food so you can starve to death while eating your fill?"
Putting on a smile took effort.
"I don't think I ever heard either one of those."
Making his voice amused required effort, too. What were the odds of her mentioning foxes giving true answers, which the eel fin did after a fashion, in the same breath with snakes stealing skins? He was pretty sure that the eel fin did, and made leather from it. But it was old Hob that nearly made him flinch. The other was likely just Treviren twisting at the world. She certainly knew nothing about him and the snakes or the foxes. In Shandala, the land where Arthur Hawkwing had been born, though, old Hob, Kaizen Hob, had been another name for the Dark One. The Aelfin and the Eelfin both surely deserved to be connected to the Dark One, yet that was hardly anything he wanted to think on when he had his own connection to the bloody foxes. And to the snakes, too? That possibility was enough to sour his stomach. Still, it was a pleasant ride, with the day warming as the sun rose, though it never could be called warm. He juggled 6 colored wooden balls, and Tuon laughed and clapped her hands as well she should. That feat had impressed the juggler he bought the balls from, and it was harder while riding. He told several jokes that made her laugh, and one that made her roll her eyes and exchange finger twitchings with Salusha. Maybe she did not like jokes about common room serving maids. It had not been the least off color. He was no fool. He did wish she laughed, though. She had a marvelous laugh, rich and warm and free. They talked of horses and argued over training methods with stubborn animals. That pretty head held a few odd notions, such as that you could calm a fractious horse by biting its ear. That sounded more likely to send it up like a haystack fire. And she had never heard of humming under your breath to soothe a horse, and would not believe his father had taught him such a skill shy of demonstration. "Well, I can hardly do that without a horse that needs soothing, can I?" he said. She rolled her eyes again. Salusha rolled hers, too. There was no heat in the argument, though, no anger, just spirit. Tuon had so much spirit it seemed impossible it could fit into such a tiny woman. It was her silences that put a small damper on the day, more so than snakes or foxes. They were far away, and there was nothing to be done. She was right there beside him, and he had a great deal to do concerning her. She never alluded to what had happened with the 3 Aes Sedai or to the sisters themselves, either. She never mentioned his Tir Angreal or the fact that whatever she had made Teslin or Jolene weave against him had failed. The night before might as well have been a dream. She was like a general planning a battle, Satala had said. Trained at intrigue and dissembling from infancy, according to Aginan. And it was all aimed straight at him. But to what end? Surely it could not be some Shonchan blood form of courting. Aginan knew little of that, but surely not. He had known Tuan a matter of weeks and kidnapped her. She called him Toy, had tried to buy him, and only a vain fool could twist that into a woman falling in love.
Which left anything from some elaborate scheme for revenge to the light alone knew what.
She had threatened to make him a cupbearer. That meant Dacovale, according to Aginan, though she had scoffed at the notion. Cupbearers were chosen for their beauty, and in Aginan's estimation, he fell far short. Well, in his own as well, truth to tell, not that he was likely to admit it to anybody. Any number of women had admired his face. Nothing said Tuan could not complete the marriage ceremony just to make him think himself home free and safe, then have him executed. Women were never simple, but Tuan made the rest look like children's games. For a long while, they saw not so much as a farm, but perhaps 2 hours after the sun passed its zenith, they came on a sizable village. The ring of a blacksmith's hammer on an anvil sounded dimly. The buildings, some of 3 stories, were all heavy timber framing with whitish plaster between, and had high-peaked roofs of thatch and tall stone chimneys. Something about them tugged at Matt's memory, but he could not say what. There was not a farm to be seen anywhere in the unbroken forest. But villages were always tied to farms, supporting them and living off them. They must all be further in from the road, back in the trees. Oddly, the people he could see ignored the approaching train of show wagons. A fellow in his shirt sleeves, right beside the road, glanced up from the hatchet he was sharpening on a grindstone, worked by a foot pedal, then bent to his work again as though he had seen nothing. A cluster of children came hurtling around a corner and darted into another street without more than a glance in the show's direction. Very odd. Most village children would stop to stare at a passing merchant's train, speculating on the strange places the merchant had been, and the show had more wagons than any number of merchant's trains. A peddler was coming from the north behind 6 horses, his wagon's high canvas cover almost hidden by clusters of pots and pans and kettles. That should have caused interest, too. Even a large village on a well-traveled road depended on peddlers for most things the people bought. But no one pointed or shouted that a peddler had come. They just went on about their business. Perhaps 300 paces short of the village, Lucas stood up on his driver's seat and looked back over the roof of his wagon.
"We'll turn in here,"
he bellowed, gesturing toward a large meadow where wildflowers, cat daisies, and jump-ups, and something that might have been lover's knots, dotted spring grasses already a foot high. Sitting back down, he suited his own words, and the other wagons began following, their wheels rutting the rain-sodden ground. As Matt turned Pips toward the meadow, he heard the shoes of the peddler's horses ringing on paving stones. The sound jerked him upright. That road had not been paved since... He pulled the gelding back around. The canvas-topped wagon was rolling over level gray paving stones that stretched just the width of the village. The peddler himself, a rotund fellow in a wide hat, was peering at the pavement and shaking his head, peering at the village and shaking his head. Peddlers followed fixed routes. He must have been this way 100 times. He had to know. The peddler halted his team and tied the reins to the brake handle. Matt cupped both hands around his mouth.
"Keep going, man!"
he shouted at the top of his lungs.
"As fast as you can! Keep going!"
The peddler glanced in his direction and hopped up on his seat, quite spryly for such a stout man. Gesturing as grandly as Luca, he began to declaim. Matt could not make out the words, but he knew what they would be. News of the world that he had picked up along the way, interspersed with lists of his goods and claims for their vast superiority. Nobody in the village stopped to listen or even paused.
"Keep going!"
Matt bellowed.
"They're dead! Keep going!"
Behind him, somebody gasped, Tuan or Salusha, maybe both. Suddenly, the peddler's horses screamed, tossing their heads madly. They screamed like animals beyond the ragged edge of terror and kept screaming. Pips jerked in fear, and Matt had his hands full. The gelding danced in circles, wanting to run in any direction so long as it was away from here. Every horse belonging to the show heard those screams and began whinnying fearfully. The lions and bears began roaring, and the leopards joined in. That set some of the show's horses to screaming, too, and rearing in their harnesses.
a tumult built on itself in moments. As Matt swung round, struggling to control Pips, everyone he could see handling reins was fighting to keep a wild-eyed team from racing off or injuring themselves. Tuon's mare was dancing too, and Salusha's done. He had a moment of fear for Tuon, but she seemed to be handling Achaean as well as she had in her race into the forest. Even Salusha seemed sure of her seat, if not of her mount. He caught glimpses of the peddler as well, pulling off his hat, peering toward the show. At last, Matt got Pips under control, blowing hard as if he had been run too hard for too long, but no longer trying to race away. It was too late. Likely, it had always been too late. Hat in hand, the round peddler leaped down to see what was the matter with his horses. Landing, he lurched awkwardly and looked down toward his feet. His hat fell from his hand, landing on the hard-packed road. That was when he began screaming. The paving stones were gone, and he was ankle-deep in the road, just like his shrieking horses. Ankle-deep and sinking into rock-hard clay, as if into a bog, just like his horses and his wagon. And the village, houses and people, melting slowly into the ground. The people never stopped what they were doing. Women walked along carrying baskets, a line of men carried a large timber on their shoulders, children darted about, the fellow at the grindstone continued sharpening his hatchet, all of them nearly knee-deep in the ground by this time. Tuon caught Matt's coat from one side, Salusha from the other. That was the first he realized he had moved Pips toward the peddler. Light.
"What do you think you can do?" Tuon demanded fiercely.
"Nothing," he replied. His bow was done, the horn knocks fitted, the linen bowstrings braided and waxed, but he had not fitted one arrow to its ash shaft yet, and with all the rain they had been having, the glue holding the goose feather fletchings was still tacky. That was all he could think of, the mercy of an arrow in the peddler's heart before he was pulled under completely. Would the man die? Or was he being carried to wherever those dead Shiotans were going? That was what had caught him about those buildings. That was how country people had built in Shiota for near enough 300 years. He could not tear his eyes away. The sinking peddler shrieked loudly enough to be heard over the screaming of his team.
"Help me!"
he cried, waving his arms. He seemed to be looking straight at Matt.
"Help me!"
over and over. Matt kept waiting for him to die, hoping for him to die. Surely that was better than the other, but the man kept on screaming as he sank to his waist, to his chest. Desperately, he tipped back his head like a man being pulled under water, sucking for one last breath. Then his head vanished, and just his arms remained, frantically waving until they too were gone. Only his hat, lying on the road, said there had ever been a man there. When the last of the thatched rooftops and tall chimneys melted away, Matt let out a long breath. Where the village had been was another meadow decked out in cat daisies and jump-ups, where red and yellow butterflies fluttered from blossom to blossom. So peaceful. He wished he could believe the peddler was dead. Except for the few that had followed Luca into the meadow, the show's wagons stood strung out along the road, and everybody was down on the ground. Women comforting crying children, men trying to quiet trembling horses, everyone talking fearfully and loudly to be heard over the bears and the lions and the leopards. Well, everyone except the three Aes Sedai. They glided hurriedly up the road, Jolene heeled by Blerick and Fenn. By their expressions, Aes Sedai and warders alike, you might have thought villages sinking into the ground were as common as house cats. Pausing beside the peddler's wide hat, the three of them stared down at it. Teslin picked it up and turned it over in her hands, then let it drop. Moving into the meadow where the village had stood, the sisters walked about talking, peering at this and that as if they could learn something from wildflowers and grasses. None had taken the time to don a cloak, but for once Matt could not find it in him to upbraid them. They might have channeled, but if so, they did not use enough of the power to make the fox head turn chilly. He would not have taken them to task if they had. Not today. Not after what he had just seen. The arguing started right away. No one wanted to cross that patch of hard-packed clay that seemingly had been paved with stone.
They shouted over one another, including the horse handlers and the seamstresses, all telling Luca what had to be done and right now. Some wanted to turn back far enough to find a country road and use those narrower ways to find their way to Lugard. Others were for forgetting Lugard altogether, for striking out for Ilion by those country roads, or even going all the way back to Abu Dhar and beyond. There was always Amadisia and Terabon, Giladon too, for that matter. Plenty of towns and cities there, and far from this shadow-cursed spot. Matt sat Pips's saddle, idly playing with his reins, and held his peace through all the shouting and arm-waving. The gelding gave a shiver now and then, but he was no longer attempting to bolt. Tom came striding through the crowd and laid a hand on Pips's neck. Julin and Amethera were close behind, she clinging to him and eyeing the showfolk fearfully, and then Noel and Ulver. The boy looked as though he would have liked to cling to someone for comfort, to anyone, but he was old enough not to want it seen if he did. Noel appeared troubled too, shaking his head and muttering under his breath. He kept peering up the road toward the Aes Sedai. Doubtless by that night he would be claiming to have seen something very like this before, only on a much grander scale.
"I think we'll be going on alone from here," Tom said quietly.
Julin nodded grimly.
"If we must," Matt replied.
Small parties would stand out for those who were hunting for Tuon, for the kidnapped heir to the Shan Chan Empire, else he would have left the show long since. Making their way to safety without the show to hide in would be much more dangerous, but it could be done. What he could not do was turn these people's minds. One glance into any of those frightened faces told him he did not have enough gold for that. There might not have been enough gold in the world.